So hi, everyone. As you just heard, I'm going to tell you about Cosmology with the HSC survey. So this is a really exciting talk for me to give because I've been working on HSC since 2009, and I spent many years giving talks about things HSC will do. And for a while, it was things HSC is in the process of doing, but now I get to actually talk about a cosmology result that is actually out. So, and it's my first time giving a talk about one of our cosmology results that, you know, is actually out there in the world, wild. So this is a really exciting thing for me. The other thing I should say, because this once caused confusion for people, like until two-thirds of the way through my talk, HSC is always going to be hyper-supra-IMCAM in this talk. It's not the Hubble Space Telescope. HSC and HST sound really, really similar. And I will sometimes refer to Hubble, but I'll always call it Hubble. Okay, so anything that sounds like HSC or HST, it's that instrument. I'm going to be talking about science with this data set, and we do have a survey webpage that describes a whole lot more science that has been done or is in the process of being done with this data set. And we also have a data release page. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, I encourage you to go check those out later. So just to set the stage a little bit, I'm going to talk about the instrument that was used to carry out the survey that I'm talking about. So I'm going to be talking about data from the Subaru telescope, which lives on Mauna Kea. And the instrument in HSC is what's called a prime focus instrument. So like the mirror is down there, and then there's a prime focus position up here. So this is like a ginormously heavy instrument that gets mounted way up above this precious primary mirror. Okay, so just to set the stage a little for, you know, why is it interesting to do a survey with this instrument? So in general, you know, if you're doing a cosmological survey, there are a few things that you need. First of all, you'd like to have good quality images. You'd like to have, you know, a site with good atmospheric seeing, and you'd like to have an instrument that doesn't, you know, significantly degrade the images. And since you want to cover decent volumes of the universe, it also needs to be fast. So you want to have, you know, a wide field of view and efficient photon collecting power so that you can cover good amounts of the sky in a manageable amount of telescope time. Okay, so this is an image from an old imager, supra-IMCAM, that was on Subaru for a long time. And you can see that its area is roughly comparable to that of the full moon. And so that was, you know, the largest imager that had been on the Subaru telescope to date. And if you compare it to the Hubble Space Telescope Advanced Camera for Surveys, this is like a cutout of a single pointing with ACS. And so you can see like that's really tiny. Obviously, that's not efficient for a large area survey. This, you know, comparable to the full moon, obviously much bigger. And yet, if you do the calculation, it's not actually that efficient to do a large area cosmological survey with this instrument. It would take a really, you know, unreasonable amount of telescope time. So HSC is a new instrument that really dwarfs the previous imager, supra-IMCAM, in area. So this is, you know, a quarter of the HSC field of view shown to scale. So it's, you know, many full moons in size. And having that really large field of view coupled with the photon collecting power of an 8-meter telescope really makes it possible to do a survey that covers areas of, you know, 1,000 square degrees, which is important for this to be a really interesting data set. So this is an image of M31, which is one of the first like test images. We had press releases when, you know, the instrument went on, and we took this image of M31. So Andromeda is, you know, pretty big on the sky. And we can see basically all of it except for a tiny bit of cutoff at the edges. And as some of you may be familiar, like there's a Hubble Space Telescope survey of Andromeda, which is taking a very large number of pointings. Actually, Dustin could maybe say how many, but
128
pointings, and it's, you know, covering a tiny fraction of this. Right? And an HSC can just look at it and get basically everything. And at the same time, you know, this is this is a camera with very high resolution, so we can see the whole thing. We can also, you know, zoom in and get a lot of fine details. So zooming into the red box and then into the pink box, you know, we can still see a lot of detail. So this is an excellent instrument if you want to both cover a large area and do a cosmological survey, but also have excellent image quality and resolution. So the survey was planned with a wedding cake strategy, which I think is kind of typical. So there is a wide survey layer, which is 1400 square degrees. Then there's a deep layer, which is only 28 square degrees, but it's like a magnitude deeper. And then there's this ultra deep field, which is even deeper. And that's really just two pointings of HSC, really. So if we try to put this in context of what else is happening in the field, this plot shows the area on the horizontal axis and the limiting magnitude on the vertical axis. So higher up on this plot is a deeper survey. So in general, the march of progress follows those arrows towards the upper right. Surveys are getting to larger area and they're getting deeper so they can survey larger volumes of the universe. Okay, so the black points are surveys that are totally completed. The pink and red are ones that are, you know, ongoing or close to completed. And then blue are future surveys. And so if you look at the pink and the red, so HSC are the three HSC numbers on here for the three survey layers. And you can see in the context of ongoing surveys, they're, you know, towards the deeper end. So they're not the largest area, but they're deeper. And that makes sense for an 8-meter telescope to sort of go for depth, like as a strategy that's more efficient than going for a shallower wide area survey. And so you can also see, if we think about, you know, preparing for the LSST survey, which is starting actually in not too long, HSC out of, you know, all of the precursor surveys, so especially ones that are working on weak gravitational lensing or HSC-wide, DES-wide in kids, you can see that HSC-wide is closest to LSST-wide in terms of depth of the survey. And so if there are, you know, interesting challenges in terms of image processing or modeling results, we're going to see them in HSC, and it's kind of the best ongoing survey to help prepare for science with LSST. We have a kind of standard filter set for cosmological surveys. So we have five broadband filters, GRIZY. And then we also have a set of narrowband filters that are used only in the deep and ultra deep surveys. And those are meant for detecting like Lyman alpha emitters and interesting objects at specific redshifts. But I'm going to be talking about the HSC wide survey, where we just have the GRIZY. And the numbers in this table are the total integration time in those bands in minutes. So like across all exposures in I-band, we integrate for 20 minutes. So the survey field locations were chosen based on essentially what other data was there or would we expect to have there eventually. So in particular, we really wanted to overlap with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And that gives us a lot of scientific synergies with spectroscopic samples at lower redshift and the HSC data that's, you know, deeper. And there are other interesting data sets like ACT and the ACT Pole Survey. There are near infrared survey overlaps, other spectroscopic surveys. So basically HSC wide is, again, which is what I'm focusing on, is like this dark red, like magenta-ish, whatever, region here, and this one over here. So it's basically two contiguous areas spread out in right ascension so that we can observe basically in any month of the year. Okay, so the survey proposal went in 2013, and we got 300 nights of Subaru time, which is enough, which under, you know, standard weather conditions and so on would be enough to carry out the survey, the three-layer survey that I described. And we started in 2014. we calculated in mid-2017 about half of the survey's time had been allocated, so we still had about half left as of that point. There hasn't been a ton of progress in the past year because we had we had a season with not so good weather, so we had time allocated that wasn't very useful. And then there was seismic activity in Hawaii in May that meant that the HSC instrument could not go on the telescope. And so there were months when nobody had HSC time. So survey progress hasn't gone too much further past mid-2017, but it has gone further past the science results I'm going to show you. The science results I'm going to show you use data collected through roughly mid-2016 or so, covering 130 square degrees. We do have another 250 square degrees to full depth and a few more 100 square degrees where we maybe are missing some filters or whatever. So, so we're not as close to finishing the survey as we had hoped we would be by now, but we do have a lot more data that can do a lot more interesting science compared to the science results I'll show you today. So in terms of what this data looks like, one of the first places we looked was in the COSMOS field, because COSMOS has really nice high-resolution data from the Hubble Space Telescope. It's, I think, the largest contiguous field imaged by Hubble. And so this is a snapshot of the COSMOS field as imaged by Hubble, and then the exact same region as imaged by HSC. And so you can see basically the Hubble image is higher resolution. You can make out slightly more fine detail than in the HSC image, so not surprising. But there's still a lot of detail here in the HSC image. And of course, it's multi-band, so you can get a nice color image out. Whereas in the COSMOS field, the Hubble imaging is in one band, and then all the other bands are from the ground. The other thing is, in terms of time, this image took about 500 hours Hubble time. Time on the Hubble Space Telescope, not 500 Hubble. That would be interesting. Sorry. And this took about 2.5 hours to integrate in three filters and make this deep color image. The image quality is really excellent. So the instrument is performing at or better than specs in terms of not degrading the really nice seeing at the site. So this is a histogram of the values of the full width half maximum of the PSF in the I band. The black curve is over the whole catalog used for our first year week lensing science, and then the smaller histograms are for individual areas within that. So if you're not used to looking at these things, this might not seem terribly meaningful. So I'll just give you some context. This is 0.58 arc seconds. That's our median. That makes weak lensing people like me drool. I mean, that's amazing. So I spent the entire, you know, first 6 years of my career working on the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and the typical seeing is 1.2 arc seconds. So, you know, and that's a linear scale, right? So in terms of area, which is what matters effectively, it's a 4 times larger PSF. And the dark energy survey has a typical seeing between 0.8 and 0.9. The kids survey does somewhat better. It's like around here in the bands that they use for weak lensing shape measurement, but it's quite shallow, unfortunately. So we have a really deep survey with really high resolution images, which is a great thing.
Remind me what the pixel scale is of HSC.
0.168 arc seconds. So we actually, it's not, so when you get here, you're starting to get sketchy in terms of Nyquist sampling. Even before you get to here, like if you get to, say, in here, it's already a challenge for some of our PSF modeling algorithms. So actually, there was some more data in like this range that we had to throw out because our PSF model diagnostics indicated that we just couldn't handle it And of course, having a high fidelity PSF model is crucial for weak lensing. So in the next data release, the one that they've been working on internally within the survey and will form the basis for a release in mid-2019, they have fixed those PSF modeling issues so that we have, some of the stuff that we had to chuck out for science is now going to be usable.
That's painful to throw out.
Yep.
it is. On the other hand, I think we were throwing out like 5% of the data. So it wasn't, I know.
The
best 5%, absolutely. I mean, for me, it was like, oh man, we were looking at these diagnostics plots and we were like, well, that's really not acceptable. But I'm very sad. But the nice thing is, I mean, for the software team, that was also kind of a blow. Because they thought, okay, we won't be able to handle below 0.4 arc seconds, maybe because it's not Nyquist sampled, but we should be okay about that. And then we showed them they were going wrong quite a bit in here, and they don't want to be doing that either. So it spurred actually a lot of effort, which was really effective, and so now we can handle that data much better. So we had our first data release in February 2017. It includes a wide range of image and catalog level products. There's a really cool sky map that you can go and you have to create a user account, which takes like 5 minutes, but then you can access all of the data products, including the sky map. You can just go like scroll around, color images, and zoom in and zoom out. It's really fun. It's easy to get sucked in and lose track of time. But I highly encourage you to check this stuff out. It includes 100 square degrees of data in all 5 bands to full depth. So the science results I'm talking about do use a slightly larger area than that. We have 130 square degrees because we're using some additional internally released products. This number is for the wide layer data, which is mostly what I'm focusing on. But there was some HSC deep data that was released as well. And there were more data products in incremental releases. There was one in early June. There was one like in September, something like that. So even in between our major data releases, which are spaced apart by like from DR1 to DR2 will be 2 years, there has been additional stuff getting released in between. And there's an issue of PASJ that has a whole slew of technical and science papers that came out this year. So you can find, those papers are also on archive, but they're collected together and have a lot of useful information about if you want to use that. So now I'm going to start talking about gravitational lensing, which is basically going to be the focus of the rest of my talk. So gravitational lensing is the deflection of light by mass, including dark matter. So there are overdensities, they have, baryonic matter, dark matter, whatever, and they're deflecting the light rays coming from objects behind them. And so in this kind of classic picture, you get, this is a massive cluster and you have these arc-like features from something that was almost directly behind this massive cluster. And there's like arcs here as well. And so the lensing features, there are positions and brightnesses and so on, tell us something about the mass distribution in the lensing, the objects doing the lensing, right? Including the distribution of dark matter in those objects. And I like showing this picture and then telling people I'm not going to talk about this anymore. That's strong gravitational lensing. I do weak gravitational lensing, but there is no nice dramatic picture for that. There are like schematic diagrams, but there's nothing that looks quite as cool. So the basic idea here is, you can think of this as strong lensing was the extreme case when there's a serendipitous superposition of, one thing almost directly in front of another thing. But if you consider, say, this lens object and like things, way out here or, over there, whatever, anywhere else on the sky, it's not like they're not affected by that object. It's just that the impact on their light profiles is not so extreme that you can pick it up by eye. And so in fact, if you consider any random object in the sky, there's a very tiny probability that it will be strongly lensed, but there's basically 100% probability that it's weakly lensed. So if we can figure out a way to measure subtle signals that are not, you know, visible to our eyes, we can use basically everything on the sky to measure the distribution of matter in the universe. Okay, so the weak lensing effect, this is in this schematic, this is us looking out into the universe, and here's some massive thing. Here is an object that has been weakly lensed, so its apparent position has changed. We, of course, don't realize that, but its shape has changed in a way that leads to preferential orientation with respect to the lens object. And crucially, if there were other objects near it, they would have, you know, a similar kind of distortion. So there would be some coherent, basically some coherent smearing of the object shapes. We refer to that as shear. And our goal is to measure those coherent shears. And the effects in general are quite small. So even this image is really exaggerated compared to an actual weak lensing distortion. Typical weak lensing distortions affect the shapes by about 1%. The magnitude of the effect depends on... So the magnitude of the lensing effect depends on the amount of mass, the projected mass doing the lensing, depends on the separation on the sky, so how close, like what's the impact parameter of the light rays, and the separation along the line of sight between us, the lens, and the source, where the most effective configuration is if the lens is roughly halfway between us and the source. So this is a diagram that I and lots of people use to try to illustrate weak lensing because it's so hard to do. So we have to take an idealized background of unlensed sources that are perfectly round. That's them. They're perfectly round. That's what makes this helpful demonstration. So if we were to plop a bunch of lenses, like, so you're the observers, those are the distance sources. If we imagine plopping a bunch of lenses, you know, in between, so somewhere in the air in between you and these sources, you would get smeary patterns in the shapes. And so someone like me that's used to looking at these kinds of images would say, okay, there was a mass here because there's coherent smearing in a, like a circle here. And there was a mass here because there's this coherent smearing. And if I find a place where it looks like the shapes are pointing radially towards it, I know there is actually an underdensity, density less than the mean in that region. So we can look for those coherent patterns and learn something about how mass is distributed all the way in between the observers and the sources. So, of course, the keen observers among you may have noticed that galaxies are not round. So that seems a little bit awkward, but the essential point remains that weak lensing induces coherent smearing patterns. And so the fact that galaxies are not round and have orientations that are essentially random is effectively a source of noise. We have to average over many galaxies before the coherent patterns will emerge, but if we average over enough, we can beat down that noise and measure the weak lensing signals. So we measure weak lensing statistically. We're measuring percent level galaxy shape distortions underneath this, you know, 30% level intrinsic ellipticities, which average down like 1/√ of the number of galaxies. So this is my one slide advertisement for why should you care about weak lensing. So it turns out weak lensing can be useful for a lot of things, and I'm interested in all of these things, so that's why I think it's fun to do weak lensing. So first thing to talk about, I guess, is structure growth. Okay, so we have a picture in our universe that, you know, in the very early universe, there were tiny perturbations in the density field. And then those were able to collapse due to gravity. Eventually, this goes nonlinear, and we need simulations to predict the evolution of the matter field from something that's, you know, kind of smooth-ish to this cosmic web-like structure at late times. And weak gravitational lensing is sensitive to this growth of structure because if we're measuring the coherent shape distortions due to cosmic structure at various times. So if you have more clumping, if you have more structure growth, then you're going to measure stronger coherent shape distortions. And so if we can measure weak lensing as a function of time, we can measure structure growth. Okay? So if we think about what that does for us on our cosmic pie chart, we're measuring the large-scale distribution of the dark matter in the universe, which is the second largest slice of our pie. but we're using it to learn about structure growth, which is also sensitive to dark energy, the biggest slice of the pie. So in 2003, 2004, when people realized how powerful weak lensing is for constraining dark energy, that led to, you know, sort of an explosion of ideas for, you know, designing surveys in future that would let us constrain dark energy using weak lensing. And so the science results that I'm going to talk about are focused on, you know, sort of these two things: measuring structure growth with weak lensing and using it to say something about dark energy. So two other science cases that I'm really interested in, but I'm not going to talk about further, are the galaxy dark matter connection. So this is a picture that you probably can't see very well. This is a spiral galaxy sitting inside of a much more extended dark matter halo. So if we find the positions of some nearby galaxies, we can average the weak lensing distortions around them and measure the average matter distributions around those galaxies. And that's going to give us a measure of their dark matter halo profiles and masses on average. So we can use weak lensing to make a connection between the visible components of galaxies that we can see and their dark matter halos, which is really valuable for placing constraints on theories of galaxy formation and evolution. Finally, gravity. This is a gravitational effect. And so if we imagine the dynamics of galaxies, say, swirling around in a potential well, that's sensitive to one of the potentials in the metric. Lensing is sensitive to both potentials. And so by combining measurements of gravitational lensing with measurements of dynamics like redshift space distortions, we can essentially probe the theory of gravity on cosmological distance scales, which is something that so far has not been done to great precision. So we're used to thinking, you know, GR has been tested so precisely within the solar system, that's true. But on cosmological distance scales, currently our tests to confirm the theory of gravity are limited just by the statistical precision in existing data, and we can make sort of 10% constraints that so far look consistent with GR, but that's, you know, hardly a slam dunk, just given the uncertainties. So future surveys that will have better statistical precision will be better able to, you know, teach us about this. Okay, so focusing, like I said, on the top two things, I'm going to start digging into how exactly this kind of measurement works. So we're measuring what some people call cosmic shear, other people call shear-shear correlations. So this is a measure of weak lensing by large-scale structure. And the basic picture to have in your head is there's this cosmic web. This is a projection, like the red, white color is the density in simulation. So it's got this webby structure. And then the light blue like ovals are indicating the direction that a galaxy, if there was a galaxy behind this structure, and it passed through this structure and got weakly lensed by it, what direction would its shape get distorted in? And so, you know, if you have, like, say, these galaxies, they're being lensed by this filament, and so they get aligned. You know, any of the shapes that are near each other are getting aligned by associated structures. And so their shapes are more correlated than galaxies, you know, like here and here, which have passed through less associated structure. So to do this, we need catalog galaxy positions on the sky, so like the blue galaxy positions on the sky, and some estimate of the weak lensing shear at their positions. And we also need roughly some way to estimate their redshift distribution, because the strength of the lensing effect depends on the distances between us and the lensing objects. And so if we want to interpret the lensing shear distortions in terms of structure growth and matter densities and so on, then we need an estimate of the redshift distribution. But even more powerful is if we can try to divide up our sample in a way that gets us better information about redshift. So this is called tomography. A tomographic measurement involves taking galaxies and dividing them up into redshift bins, roughly. We don't have spectroscopic redshifts, but we have photometric redshifts. We can use that to divide them up into bins. So this is an example of a 6-bin measurement, and then estimate the redshift distribution for each of those bins. They'll be overlapping because photometric redshifts aren't perfect, but still, you can imagine, you know, in this case, they were getting information from redshift 0.3 up to redshift 1.2, and use that to measure structure growth. So if you want to do this, then you actually need, you know, individual galaxy redshift estimates like PhotoZ that you can use to divide up your catalog in this way, and you need to be able to calibrate to understand the statistical relationship between those PhotoZ and the redshifts. So if we ask what we should be able to do with the HSC survey, can we measure structure growth and use that to constrain the equation of state of dark energy as a function of time? The forecast constraints that we get are shown in this plot on red, in red. So basically, if we were to imagine trying to constrain some parametric equation for the equation of state as a function of time, the question is, what is the uncertainty on W as a function of redshift? And so the red curve shows there's some sweet spot we can best constrain the equation of state of dark energy around redshift 0.7, and then it gets worse at low redshift. That's because shear signals are weaker at low redshift, and we're also probing a smaller effective volume of the universe. And then at high redshift, the constraints get worse because we're eventually just running out of source galaxies at high redshift. So our sweet spot, like I said, is around redshift 0.7. If we compare that to a survey like Dark Energy Survey, so Dark Energy Survey is a wider area survey by like a factor of 3 or so, but it's also shallower. And so its forecast constraints using similar methodology are shown in blue. And so the impact of the different survey design is that the Dark Energy Survey does a better job at low redshift and HSC does a better job at high redshift. And so these surveys are kind of, you know, complementary and interesting to combine together eventually. So before we can do cosmology with weak lensing, we have to measure, make some estimator for the weak lensing shear, which generally involves measuring galaxy shapes and doing some form of weighted average that you calibrate in various ways. So this paper is about the catalog that we use to do that. So we have to do very precise measurements of the point spread function, which blurs all the galaxy images. We need to measure that extremely precisely so that we can remove its impact on the galaxy shapes. So we have some plots. Wow, this is poor resolution. So this is basically showing, as a function of seeing size, this is some diagnostic of how well did we measure the PSF size. And so we want to be within this gray, dark gray region, which corresponds to measuring the PSF size to something like 0.5%. And this spray of points up here in orange at small seeing around 0.4 to 0.5 is that clump of points that I said we had to throw out at very good seeing because they had the PSF sizes were off by 5%, 10%, way outside of our tolerances. And that's something that's now been fixed, which is great. But for this catalog, we had to throw them out. And so there are many other diagnostics. I'm not going to talk through all of these. But in the end, once we made the cuts we thought we needed for quality, which eliminated some areas and also eliminated, you know, some galaxies across the whole area, we came out with an effective number density of galaxies that's around 21 per square arc minute. So, and for weak lensing people, this is amazing. It's because we have both a deep survey with very high resolution. And like I said, I spent a lot of my career on SDSS. We had one galaxy per square arc minute. So factor of 21, kind of amazing. We have other ways of testing for systematic uncertainties. So one way is using mass maps. So you can use the shape catalog to basically derive a map of the total mass due to lensing. And so that was some work led by Masamune Oguri. So this is a map. This is the mass map in one of our fields. So white is the highest projected density. The bottom is just if you take luminous red galaxies and add up their stellar mass estimates and make a map, and you can see that there's some correspondence between the high mass peaks and the underdensities and so on, which we would hope would be the case because LRGs live in dense environments. And then you can use this.
So the number, is it amounts of noise in the map? Or?
Good question. So on the top one, the number is definitely the signal to noise. Here it means something different. I don't remember what the scale means on that. But here, yeah, it's that, that's the signal to noise of the peak. So like this is a four sigma peak. So we can use this, these maps, in addition to this sort of by eye sanity check, we can use this for quantitative tests by making maps of quantities that we think can generate systematics. So if you have something that you think can generate a systematic, like the PSF, you would make might make a map of the of the seeing size across the field, or the PSF ellipticity, or you could just choose any other quantity, the air mass, whatever. And then correlate those maps with the total mass from lensing. So systematics quantity should not correlate in any way with the mass in the universe. If you find a correlation, it means that the systematic has contaminated your map, and that's bad. So this plot shows the correlation coefficients between pairs of maps, where for every point except the last one, we're correlating the real lensing map with some quantity that is indicative of systematics only. And so you can see that the points are fluctuating around zero, but there's no sign for a significant signal in any of the systematics tests. And then this last point, which is around a correlation of 0.5, is the correlation between these two mass maps, the stellar mass and the total mass, which we do expect to have a correlation. So the fact that there's a correlation is a good thing. So this is something that gives us confidence that these maps can be used for science, that the Shear catalog can be used for science. Another thing we do is we use simulations to test our ability to infer weak lensing shear. So we make simulated data that we try to make look like HSC. We put in HSC PSFs, noise levels, and so on with fake shear signals. And then we say, okay, can we recover the shear signals? And we use that, you know, to check our analysis methodology. And one of the interesting things that comes out of that, which I'll get back to a little bit later, is the importance of blending. So if we just take a bunch of galaxies with light profiles that are based on the Hubble Space Telescope, a bunch of isolated galaxies from the Hubble Space Telescope, plop them down in an image well separated from each other and simulate the HSC survey, measure all the galaxies and so on. And then we check how well resolved are the galaxies. Think of this horizontal axis as how big are the galaxies? And we have a cut, that's why there's a heart. So if we do that, we get something like this magenta curve. And in the real data, the size distribution is like this black curve. So something's wrong. What's wrong is we put the galaxies well separated. In real life, the galaxies are not sufficiently well separated that we can always tell, you know, Is this peak one galaxy or is it two galaxies? Or maybe they're close to each other and the measurement of one is contaminated by the light from the other. So if we don't make the simulations, you know, artificially separate all the galaxies, but we have them distributed on the sky in a realistic way, then we get this dashed blue line, which matches the real data quite closely. And so this basically shows that, you know, the simulations can reproduce the observed galaxy properties if and only if we include realistic contributions from neighboring objects. So blending is really important for this data set. And like I said, I'll come back to that later. So now I'm going to show you some results for cosmological measurements using cosmic shear. This is a paper that was on the archive about a month and a half ago, led by Chiaki Hikage. So we used tomography, so that's dividing up into redshift bins. We have four redshift bins ranging from redshift 0.3 to 1.5. They're defined using some particular photo Z estimate that I'm not going to talk about in detail. We have the effective number density of galaxies in each bin with a total of 16.5. So that's lower than the 21 I mentioned to you earlier, just because we cut out certain photo Z ranges where we don't really trust the photometric redshifts. Just to focus on regimes that we think we can actually calibrate and understand. So then we use the weak lensing maps to measure power spectra. So these are weak lensing power spectra in tomographic bins. So like one for means we correlated the galaxies in the lowest redshift bin with the highest redshift bin to measure the power spectrum. 4.4 means highest redshift bin correlated with itself, and so on. So the diagonal ones are all the autocorrelations, and then cross correlations are shown in these other panels. And in particular, the cosmological signal we're interested in are the red points, whereas the blue and yellow are essentially systematics tests. They should be zero. So for our analysis, we use L, wave number L between 300 and 1900. The low L cut is determined in part by the fact that our field for first year science is actually not very big, 130 square degrees, but it's actually six distinct chunks each, you know, so typical size more like 25 square degrees. That means you can't go to very large scale correlations. There are also signs of systematics on the very largest scales we could measure. So we placed a cut. I think we could have gone to 200, but we cut it at 300. And then the cut at high L at small physical scales is driven by systematics, astrophysical systematics that are difficult to model. So we have a total signal to noise of 16 if we add up all of these bins in the L range that we're using for our analysis. So then we have redshift distributions of the galaxies, which I'm actually not going to talk through this because I want to have enough time to show you the results. So
there was total signal to noise of 16, you said, in the shear power spectrum?
In the shear power spectrum.
But your map, I thought, had like, you know, well, your mass map, I thought, had a much higher cumulative signal to noise. And so why is the...
Well, the signal to noise of the one-point statistics and the two-point statistics is not going to be exactly the same. The other thing is the one-point statistics that you were looking at in the map effectively include both smaller and, you know, smaller and larger scales, but especially smaller scales than we used in this analysis. Yeah. So if we measure the power spectrum, you know, we can go out to L of 5,000 or whatever, which would correspond more to like the peaks in that map, then the total signal to noise would be quite a bit higher. It's just a, you know, information on different scales. Okay, so for our cosmological parameter constraints, the top chunk lists parameters that were part of our fiducial fits. So our baseline analysis was actually with W fixed to -1. So we did tests later, like as an extended analysis with, you know, letting it vary. But our initial analysis was lambda CDM, flat lambda CDM, with neutrino mass fixed at 0, although again, in an extended analysis, we let it vary. And then the bottom shows various systematics parameters that we marginalize over, corresponding to uncertainties in shape measurement, photometric redshifts, intrinsic alignments of galaxy shapes with the density field, impact of baryonic physics on the distribution of matter. And we explored the impact of all of these choices prior to unblinding our measurements. So we carried out a blinded measurement and did all the systematics tests that we could possibly think of before opening up the box and seeing what cosmological parameter constraints we had, which was one of the most exciting telecons I've ever been on. Okay, so this plot shows the same signals as before, but now with the model fits shown on top of them. So the total model, including all components, are the solid lines, and you can see they go nicely through the data points. And our best fit chi-squared is around 45 with 57 degrees of freedom. So this is a good model for the data. As I mentioned, we tested the impact of all of our choices, our modeling choices, before unblinding. So this is a plot that we were looking at for many months, except that before it was centered at 0 rather than at our best fit value because we weren't looking at our best fit values. So I'm not going to go through all of these in detail, but just to give you a flavor, the different color bars show us testing different things, like removing any modeling, any marginalization over shape uncertainties, photosensitivity uncertainties, changing our intrinsic alignments model, letting mass and neutrino parameters vary, changing our baryonic physics model, excluding redshift bins one by one, changing the L ranges, fixing our covariance to the best fit cosmology. And our results for S8, which is essentially the best fitting, the best constrained combination of sigma 8 and omega matter, are pretty robust to these choices. And finally, here is actually a scientific difference. If, you know, if we, this has not, this bottom one has nothing to do with modeling choices. This is within lambda CDM. This is if we use WCDM and let W change, then our error bars on S8 get larger and the central value shifts.
That's just from the lensing data alone, not putting any CMB constraints, or?
Yeah, that's correct. With there are quite wide priors on all the parameters here. I'll show with CMB in a sec. I'm going to skip this because of time and show what happens if you compare with other surveys. So basically, this is S8, like I said, the best constrained parameter combination in the sigma 8 omega matter plane versus omega matter. And so, like, Planck is this purple thing. And then the red, blue, and green are HSC, DES, and KITS. So what you can see is that HSC and DES agree quite well in S8. It agrees on the overall amplitude of matter fluctuations. There is a little bit of tension in omega matter, but we use tension metrics and check that this is not actually statistically significant tension in the omega matter direction. So that could just be noise. If you can kind of see, if you were to compare all of these lensings, combine all of these lensing surveys and get a combined lensing constraint, there are hints that it might be lower than Planck at a level that's statistically significant. Individual comparisons of like Planck versus DES or Planck versus HSC, there is no significant evidence for tension at this point. And this just shows a 1D projection of S8 constraints. So this is HSC and DES, quite consistent. KIDS, real space measurement, also consistent. KIDS, Fourier space measurement, a bit low. And here's Planck up here. And so that's what I was saying about how the lensing surveys, you know, seem to kind of give a consistently somewhat lower value.
So is all this, you know, so far just using only shear?
That's correct.
So you haven't used like the full 3x2 Planck functions?
That's right. So we have an analysis going on right now that uses the other two out of the three cross two points, so galaxy shear and galaxy galaxy together, but without shear, and then we'll combine all three. There are some interesting like modeling issues to resolve as you build up, and so we were tackling those separately. Okay, so this is I mentioned earlier. You know, if we can then enlarge our parameter space and fit for W. If we do that, so. You know, here's Planck constraints are the blue and are the gray, I'm sorry. And then the blue is HSC. And so we can combine those. There's, you know, that there's no sign for tension in those parameter spaces. So we can just combine and we get the yellow. And if we include as well BAO and JLA, we get this red. So the results in Hikage et al. Are our first cosmology results from HSC. So like I said, very exciting, having been working on this since 2009. We have a 3.6% measurement of the amplitude of fluctuations, S8. They're statistically consistent with the expectations from Planck, but it's interesting that all contemporary independent weak lensing surveys give slightly lower results than Planck, and so there's a lot to really dig into here with additional data with HSC and DES now and LSST in future. I am running out of time. So I'm going to show you one more plot only. Yep, a few things. Okay, so HSC image from the deep field. There's stuff everywhere, you know, like everywhere. Okay, so, and this is our future, like LSST is going to be this deep. So if you look at the HSC pipeline paper, there's this quote in the wide layer, so what we use for lensing, 58% of all objects are members of blends. They might not be, you know, very significantly blended. So you could be a member of a blend if you have a tiny overlap at the edge of the lay profile. The pipeline will still pick that up and try to allocate flux properly. Still, 58%. So you can't just say, oh, I'm going to throw those guys out. Nope. So you need to understand the impact of blending and be able to deblend effectively and have schemes for mitigating the impact of any residual systematics afterwards. And that is even worse, 66% and 74% in the deep and ultra deep layers, which really has implications for surveys like LSST. Okay, so I'm going to conclude here. HSC survey had its first data release. I told you about just one science results, but there are tons of great results in you know multiple different science areas. There's some really cool strong lensing stuff happening, galaxy science. So keep an eye on archive. And we're doing great science with this excellent data set, and we're also preparing for the next generation of surveys like LSST. Thank you.
Question. I can't remember what the forecasted seeing is for LSST. In the context of that question is thinking about whether this, you know, infusion problem will be worse or better.
So yes.
I don't know for from DES, so and the DES results that they show are always for the gold sample that isn't the supernova sample that they do when the weather's bad. Yeah. Or when seeing is bad, rather.
Yes. So it's a great question. I was actually staring at projected seeing histograms like a few days ago because the LSST project is now trying to, it issued a call for white papers and observing strategy, and you could imagine wanting to explore strategies that preferentially do better seeing in certain bands or whatever. And so when I looked at those histograms without any preference for, you know, good seeing in a certain band or whatever, the mode of the distribution, what they were predicting was, you know, more like 0.75 or so in I band. So it was definitely like it was better than DES, but substantially worse than this. So
it also seems hopelessly optimistic to me. Is that for like a dim looking straight up?
No. So that was they had a dim that looked straight up. Then they factored in what is the zenith angle, the observation, and also the instrumental specs for how much the optics will add. And they put in wavelength dependence as well. I think I was looking at R band. So obviously it's gonna depend on the band as well. But yeah, that was what was coming out of OPSIM.
So if you're going a magnitude or so deeper, but with worse seeing, then I guess it's really kind of tricky, it's really bad. What's going on?
Yeah, so one reason that the Dark Energy Science Collaboration, which is preparing for dark energy science with LSST, is doing a large simulation campaign now, is to build up a simulated data set that would let us explore that. So using, you know, estimates of, like, we have, you know, whatever the models are giving for the the individual exposure depth and you know seeing distribution and its correlation with air mass and all of that for a simulated survey, which is small, it's only 300 square degrees, but going to tenure depth so that we can then you know test the impact of blending on the outputs of the DM stack using the current deblender, and we can reprocess later if there are better deblenders and so on. And we can also, we're talking about making co-eds in quartiles in seeing, so like the quarter best seeing, the quarter worst seeing, whatever, and check how sensitive we are to that. Because it's really on the radar as one of the, you know, the outstanding problems that previous surveys will not solve for us, because the previous surveys are not as affected by blending. And I mean, it is still the limiting systematic for HSC and DES, but HSC and DES are going to solve it at the level of precision they need. And LSST needs better precision. So it's very much on the radar as you know, our problem that we must fix.
So is the deep blending done normally by forward modeling, or is there some other approach?
So, do you want to take this one?
No, I really don't.
Yes. So there's what's currently in the pipeline, and then there's, you know, a deblender that was developed but isn't yet in the pipeline, and then there are other future plans. By and large, it's not done by a full forward modeling approach, but rather by, like, you know, they find something that they think has multiple peaks, and, you know, there are some symmetry prescriptions and whatever that lead to an allocation of flux. And people have talked about, you know, like, you could imagine doing a full forward model approach where you, I'm trying to, I'm like trapped holding it. Okay. Where you, like, if you think there are two objects in a blend or something, fitting the light profile simultaneously, and then you also need to do science with that, you also need to understand the full covariance, because then you'll have a covariance between the properties of this and the properties of that. And, you know, how can we store that in the catalog? It's a big covariance matrix. You could also draw random samples from it, but that's not currently something that's implemented. And it hasn't been demonstrated that it is, you know, implementable and doable for science. But yeah, good question. I mean, this is an area where it's expected that there's going to be some evolution in methodology, potentially substantial evolution in methodology.
We're seeing helps because you don't have to have models that are quite as good of the detailed structures of the galaxies.
There's more blending, though. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's more blending, but you don't. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's used for a moment. Yeah. It's better and worse.
But the reason why it's not, like, practical just is, you know, just like computational, or it's hard to store the covariance matrix. It's hard to sample enough. Is like, that's the reason why a full forward model is not practical?
The models are also tricky. Like, we don't have a good forward model for galaxy, for instance, right? Like, you know, we can do, like, cheap elliptical, you know, radial profile
disks
shapes
together. Aren't they all bulges and disks stuck together?
As long as you.
It's not clear that would be good enough. Yeah.
So the data release in 2019 will be how many square degrees? Approximately.
I think they're going to stick again with full depth, full color. So then that would be something like 300, I think. Yeah. Sherry, do you remember?
Question mark.
I know it's more than double, but not triple. So somewhere in between. More than double and not triple of our 130 square degree internal one that we're using.
All right, let's take our show down.